Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Mitch Fifield makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here on a number of occasions. The minister joined the Senate as a Senator of Victoria in 2004. He had ministerial positions in September 2013, and of course in the Cabinet as the Minister for Arts and Communications since September 2015. The Minister's a very busy person. We're very pleased he's here tonight, and the topic for the talk is the Internet, not an ungoverned space. Minister Fifield, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Jared and Anne, and can I acknowledge what a unique institution that you have created through the Sydney Institute, making an important contribution to public policy debate over many decades. And can I also say how heartened I am whenever I'm at a gathering and there are a good number of people who are in attendance because they like to talk about policy. So great to be with you all. When I was last here in 2016, I spoke about the communications sector being in a state of transition and how the NBN was changing the landscape, but particularly for the online environment. Tonight, I'd like to look forward and talk about the future of the internet and the role that the government has in that space. As you all know, the internet has fundamentally reshaped our economy and our society. I can still remember the first time I heard about the web from a computer scientist friend in about 1993. But I thought to myself, this thing will never take off. 25 years later, I find myself, in a sense, the minister for it. The internet has unleashed innovation, it's underpinned economic growth, it's connected individuals and communities in ways that we could not have imagined a few decades ago. Now, my computer scientist friend in 1993 described the web as chaos, as anarchy, and as freedom. And for the first decade or two of the internet, that's pretty much how regulators, governments, and platforms viewed it. But there has been a fundamental change in thinking over the last 5 to 8 years on the part of community and the government when it comes to the internet. It's no longer seen as an ungoverned space or a libertarian free-for-all. So it's important to recognise what the internet is not. It's not the Wild West, where the rule of law and standards of decency shouldn't apply, and it's not a place where anything goes. It's a shared space, and all Australians should be able to participate online and reap the benefits of a globalised world without experiencing offensive or harmful content. There's a clear role for government and industry to work together to ensure the interests of our community are protected, supported and promoted in the online environment, just as they are elsewhere. Laws and norms should apply in the virtual world just as they do in the physical world. This is increasingly being seen in tax law, copyright law, competition law, criminal law, civil law, and privacy law. Now, this doesn't mean the attitude of government is to regulate first. The government values the individual and their exercise of free choice. This is the starting position. Our focus is very much on responsibility. Individuals need to be responsible and accountable for their behaviour online as both producers of content and consumers. Businesses who rely on the attention of their users and user-generated content need to prevent their services and platforms from being misused. And government has a responsibility to ensure individuals and businesses engage in appropriate behaviour online and to act decisively when this doesn't occur. Already, we have, as a government, taken significant steps to reform our media and digital sectors to make them viable and fit for purpose in the 21st century. We've modernised our broadcasting regulatory arrangements, addressed online safety issues, and are reforming Australia's copyright laws. But beyond this, we will be assessing the need for further reform, particularly given the far-reaching impact of digital platforms such as Google, Facebook and others. But before I outline some of the challenges, it's important to set the broader scene. The internet has revolutionised our world, creating new businesses, products and ways to communicate. The benefits of search engines, social media and other online content aggregators has been significant. Citizens have greater choice and easier access to services and can create and consume content like never before. Content creators have lower barriers to entry, cheaper content production and distribution costs, and the ability to reach niche audiences in increasingly sophisticated ways. Now, some in our community look back to earlier, simpler times, a period before the internet when the pace of life was much slower, before the 5 a.m. WhatsApp message was received, which isn't always welcome. Now, it might have been quieter, it might have been simpler, but we are unquestionably in a better position. Our well-being, our standard of living has very much been enhanced. Now, while remaining optimistic about the future of the internet, one of its founders, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, has recently voiced his concerns about the evolution of the internet into an engine of inequality and divisions, swayed by powerful forces who use it for their own agendas. But we need to recognise and deal with the challenges. The internet creates, for instance, new ways of defaming others that were not possible in the analog world. It means bullying can transcend the schoolyard. It can expose the community to scams and fake news. As the internet became mainstream in the late 1990s, most jurisdictions, including Australia, did adopt a largely hands-off approach, not wanting to burden an emerging and largely undefined industry. Back then, the internet played a secondary role to traditional broadcasting and print media. Those traditional mediums were the channels that warranted government intervention, where the risks of concentrated ownership and lack of diversity were greatest, and where the community needed a strong voice. But the goalposts have shifted. The internet has become a vehicle for change, a platform for new business models to emerge, to disrupt, and to compete with the traditional media markets. The main drivers for this change have been the digital platforms, the search engines dominated by Google, social media outlets dominated by Facebook, and other content aggregators such as Apple News. The ability for people to access and share a greater range of content via these platforms has fundamentally changed the relationship between citizens and government, between media companies and audiences, and between communities and groups in society. Just to take a look at the platform use in Australia, it is prolific. In 2017, Google accounted for 90% of search traffic originating from domestic desktop users and over 98% of domestic mobile search traffic. In April this year, there were over 13.5 million daily active users of Facebook. Platforms are also now a dominant source of news. A recent survey by Reuters found that across 36 countries, including Australia, two-thirds of online news consumption is channeled through algorithm-driven platforms like search engines, news aggregators, and social media websites. This rises to almost three-quarters for those aged under 35. But over half of the respondents used a Facebook product to access news, including WhatsApp, Messenger and Instagram. Platforms have the potential to enhance our levels of civic engagement, but there are real concerns about the impact of the platforms, particularly social media, on civic society. And we've been very conscious of this as a government and at the forefront of making the internet a safer, more secure and hopefully more positive environment for the community. In 2013, we established the world's first Children's E-Safety Commissioner, a dedicated statutory position with a clear mandate to improve community awareness of online safety risks for kids and to be a cop on the beat against cyberbullying. In 2016, we expanded the remit of the Commissioner to cover online safety for all Australians. This shift recognised that online safety issues were a whole of community matter, and this has extended the Commissioner's reach to targeted programs for older Australians, women and vulnerable groups. We created the eSafety Commissioner because we recognised the most vulnerable in the community were having harmful online experiences and intervention was needed. Several other countries are watching what we're doing in Australia, and in particular Ireland is considering establishing a digital safety commissioner modelled on our approach. We've also taken strong action on illegal and offensive content online. We've strengthened the criminal offences around this type of content, particularly child sexual abuse material. And recently, the Home Affairs Portfolio established the Australian Centre to Counter Child Exploitation. And this dedicated agency brings together law enforcement and national security agencies, regulators, industry and NGOs. And in my portfolio, the Safety Commissioner completed 8,000 investigations into child abuse material online last financial year and identified more than 35,000 images and videos for removal. And in August, the Parliament passed the government's legislation to create new civil and new criminal offences for the non-consensual sharing of intimate images and gave the eSafety Commissioner new powers to order the removal of this material. Civil penalties of up to $105,000 for individuals and up to $525,000 for corporations can be applied for non-compliance. The legislation also introduced two new aggravated offences for the Commonwealth offence of using a carriage service to menace, harass or cause offence, which had a maximum penalty of 3 years imprisonment. The new aggregated offences increased the maximum penalty to 5 years imprisonment, where intimate images are involved, and 7 years imprisonment for repeat offenders of the civil penalty regime. This is, like the establishment of the eSafety Commissioner, another area where we are leading the world. We've also empowered the eSafety Commissioner to order the removal from social media platforms of cyberbullying material directed at children. The eSafety Commissioner can issue takedown, service cessation and link deletion notices to remove prohibited content or block access to prohibited content. Non-compliance with end-user notices and social media notices can attract fines of up to $17,000 a day. To date, the good news is the eSafety Commissioner has resolved almost 1,000 complaints about cyberbullying material targeting children and has had a 100% success rate in removing harmful cyberbullying material with the cooperation of social media services. We've also reformed online gambling and gambling advertising. Australians, that we know, courtesy of a recent issue in discussion today, love a punt. And this is made easier through the mobile devices that we carry. But we do recognise the harm that can arise from online gambling, and we're ensuring that online gambling has stronger consumer protections. Last year, we strengthened the regulatory framework to combat illegal offshore gambling. Online gambling is a big business, generating significant economic activity and employment. And as a legitimate recreational activity for adults, it's important that there are appropriately licensed and regulated options available for people to use. But without proper controls, a series of risks emerge. For instance, proper identity verification is necessary to ensure that minors aren't opening and using betting accounts. Information sharing between wagering operators and sporting bodies is essential to ensure that players and officials aren't betting, and also to detect any unusual betting patterns that may flag integrity issues. Such safeguards are not available where offshore operators are involved. And worse, many overseas wagering operators are, to borrow a phrase, bad hombres. Now, with links to organised crime syndicates, and far worse, they are the last place we should enable Australian gambling dollars to reach. So the government passed new laws to make it clear that offering wagering services to Australians without having first obtained a licence from an Australian state or territory comes with heavy criminal and civil penalties. And we have a number of other measures to crack down on illegal offshore wagering operators targeting Australians, including placing individuals involved in these outfits on travel alert lists and closer cooperation with partner regulators and agencies in other jurisdictions. And we've listened to community concerns by restricting gambling advertising on online platforms during live sporting events. These restrictions mirror those that we recently introduced for broadcasters and deliver consistency across broadcasting and online platforms. But law and regulation can only do so much. Industry can and must play a role. Digital platforms like Google, Twitter, Apple, and Facebook are omnipresent in our lives. They are the gateways to the internet. They're modern shopping malls, mediating and guiding consumer choices. They are the town squares in which increasingly we stay informed. Their businesses have reshaped the economics of media and fundamentally reshaped the production, distribution, consumption of content. These large technology companies are not passive platforms. They reward and get rewarded for content that engages users. In turn, they profit from selling that attention to advertisers. But it's clear that they regularly alter their content mix through algorithms and human intervention. As larger digital platforms define and shape our engagement with government, businesses and each other, they should be more accountable for the content on their platforms. But there are some positive trends. Digital platforms and online content providers are increasingly realising that they have a duty of care in the communities and markets that are brought together by their services. I see this as coming to terms with the reality of their social licence, in much the same way that traditional media services recognised and accepted their social licence to the community in the 19th and 20th centuries. These providers are taking steps to make their platforms and services safer, to reduce the capacity for manipulation and exploitation, to enhance data privacy and to support quality and accurate news. This is welcome. As a government, we expect industry to take the first steps in responding to community standards for appropriate behaviours online. But it remains to be seen whether their actions will be enough. The internet should be free from unnecessary government intervention, but where platforms fail to act to reduce harm, we won't hesitate to do so. The community is watching, and we will act if the response of industry falls short of the mark. Now, online issues do manifest themselves in a number of unique ways. Firstly, there's the question of scale. Digital and online media is operating on a scale that dwarfs the analogue environment. In 2017, YouTube reached a new record. Every minute, 400 hours of content was updated. And if you consider the breadth of other platforms that allow users to create content such as Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr and Instagram, the sheer scale of this difference becomes apparent. Secondly, the large platforms have upended the relationship between content producer and consumer. This isn't of itself a cause for concern. Business models can and should change. This is part and parcel of the creative disruption at the heart of modern economies. But it does change the environment in which government is trying to make the internet a safer place that meets community expectations. And thirdly, the diversity of content on digital platforms is almost infinite, and the divide between professional and user-generated content is eroding. Anyone with a camera or a computer or an internet connection can create, upload and share content. And this content can, and often does, attract more attention than mainstream media outlets. So these attributes of the internet and the online world require specific policy responses regarding data, disinformation and digital marketplaces. The policy dimension is that in the online world, data is the ultimate commodity. Digital platforms are based on consumer data and the ability to monetise that data by providing advertising opportunities to specific and targeted audiences, while search engines and social media platforms provide services that deliver enormous benefit for consumers at no cost. The real price of access is consumer data, their browsing history, their purchase history, and their location. Around the world, communities are, quite rightly, becoming more aware of their data and privacy online. And two issues are emerging: whether consumers genuinely understand what they are agreeing to and signing up to use services, and data security. Most of us have had first-hand experience with online terms and conditions, or more accurately, we've seen them and clicked agree. It's fair to say that the terms of service and privacy policies for many online services are confusing and complicated. They don't always set out clearly and simply what information the companies hold or how they'll use it. And we've seen some alarming instances of data breaches in recent times. Our regulators are taking action. The Office of the Australian Information Commissioner is working closely with its international counterparts to investigate recent instances. And under the Data Breach Notification Scheme, entities subject to the Privacy Act must notify individuals if their personal data has been involved in a serious breach, so that affected individuals can act quickly to minimise damage. Between the 22nd of February this year, when the scheme commenced, and the 30th of June this year, 365 breach notifications were made to the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner. The second policy dimension is disinformation. This is, in a sense, nothing new and has been around for as long as we've had a functioning media. What is new is the ways that it spreads and how its impact is being amplified online. Over the last few years, we've seen an increase in intentionally misleading and inaccurate news. Often, this can be relatively harmless clickbait designed to draw users to specific sites, but it can be more malevolent. The size and the reach of the major digital platforms intensifies this potential at an unprecedented scale and speed, meaning they can be used by all sorts of actors to cause harm. These platforms play a significant part in the propagation and consumption of fake news. A 2016 study in the US found that 42% of traffic to fake news sites was through social media and 22% via search engines. And some research suggested there is a strong correlation between Facebook use and reading false news articles, particularly for those users spending significant amounts of time on the platforms. Now, while the overall consumption of fake news is around one-tenth of genuine news sites, it's discussed and engaged with as much as real news. Indeed, some studies have shown that fake news reaches further and faster than actual news, reflecting our bias towards novel and popular content. The major platforms know that they have a role to play in addressing fake news. They're using automation to identify fake sources and close fake accounts, removing the capacity to monetize this type of content. They're also beginning to educate consumers and are working with independent third parties to fact check in some cases, and this is starting to have an effect. At the heart of these concerns is a systemic vulnerability of social media platforms to this type of manipulation. Fake news producers can artificially boost traffic to their own content by means of bots and troll factories, fake websites and fake social media accounts. Algorithms are geared to pick up content that is trending and push it up in search rankings and news feeds. Controversial information is also often prioritised to boost user engagement. Now, the third and final policy dimension I want to touch on this evening goes to the economy-wide impacts of the digital marketplace. Creative and cultural content is increasingly digitised and made available in the online space, and this is a positive thing. It makes content more widely available, particularly for regional and rural communities. Creators can also find audiences and build their profiles directly with the public in ways that haven't been possible in the past. The online environment also provides enormous opportunities for news publishers, broadcasters, film studios, and other content producers to reach new audiences and expand their businesses. But there are challenges. Online and digital technologies have unbundled media content production and consumption. In this sense, media content has been atomised, reduced to individual articles or episodes. At the same time, the mass market for advertising has been pulled apart, with revenue moving to specific providers with the ability to precisely target users. And consumers have been slow to accept paying for content online. Research from the Harvard Business Review indicates consumers don't value digital services as highly as physical goods because they don't have that same feeling of ownership. And this makes intuitive sense. There's something satisfying about holding a bound paper book in your hands, or putting a CD, or, dare I say it, a vinyl record on the stereo. But these trends are making it challenging for our content creators to generate a return on their investment and on creative endeavour. Digital platforms, I must say, though, aren't wholly responsible for these impacts. They had little to do with the shift of classified advertising revenue from print publications to online providers such as realestate.com and seek.com. Nonetheless, they are playing a significant part in the process and are having a material impact on Australian content and creative practice. Our focus is ensuring our creative industries, our film producers, broadcasters and publishers can compete on a level playing field. A major focus in this space has been combating piracy, and the Australian film and television industry deserves great credit for tackling two of the biggest drivers of piracy, attitudes and availability. And let's be clear, privacy is theft. Downloading an illegal copy of a movie or a TV show is no different to walking into JB Hi-Fi and swiping a DVD off the shelf. In both cases, those who have invested their capital and time into producing a creative work are left unremunerated for their work. The industry has also taken steps to ensure that content is made available to Australians in a timely manner and at reasonable prices. And this has reduced the incentive for people to engage in piracy when you can. For example, watch the latest episode of Game of Thrones at the same time as the rest of the world and for a modest subscription fee. But government has a role to play as well. Online piracy probably won't ever be eliminated, but we can make life harder for the pirates, and we owe it to those who've had a go at creative enterprise to back them with assistance to secure their property rights. One initiative introduced by the government has been the website blocking scheme in the Copyright Act. Where a website's primary purpose is copyright infringement, a site like the Pirate Bay, for example, rights holders can bring action in the federal court to seek orders that internet service providers block access to it. Such a scheme, understandably, made some people initially uncomfortable. We certainly don't want to be a nation in which the government blocks access to web content that it doesn't like. But where a site exists purely to facilitate piracy, and with judicial oversight playing a crucial role, the website blocking scheme has been very successful in further reducing copyright infringement. And if there are further enhancements to the scheme, we're open to them. If we continue to have successful and vibrant creative industries in Australia, we must support that investment by doing what we can to prevent theft of these works. This is essential if we want Australian voices to be heard and Australian stories to be told, not only in Australia, but also abroad. So where to from here? Well, in December, the ACCC will release a draft report of its inquiry into digital platforms. This was a reference given to the ACCC by the government last year as part of our media reform endeavours. The report will consider the impact of digital platforms on competition, advertising, news and journalistic content, and the implications for consumers, including privacy. This inquiry into digital platforms is a world first. And from the 73 submissions published on the ACCC's website, the following key issues have been canvassed by submitters. It's been asserted that digital platforms are monetising content created by media organisations without contributing to the cost of content creation. Also canvassed is the proposition that advertising revenue is shifting from traditional media to digital platforms, eroding the business model of traditional media organisations. Also canvassed the proposition that digital platforms are collecting and using data at scale, allowing them to leverage that data and create a competitive advantage in the market. Also put forward is that they're using algorithms that risk creating echo chambers and filter bubbles, that platforms can become gatekeepers and set parameters of the market, particularly to the commercial disadvantage of media organisations. And also there's a view that regulation should be updated to keep up to date with changes in the market and to level the playing field for both digital platforms and traditional media organisations. The ACCC's work will be important and it will provide us with a wider and deeper perspective. And it will be an important input into this debate to ensure that our policy and regulatory settings strike the right balance in a contemporary global media environment. As a starting point, we will seek to regulate only where necessary, but we will make further interventions where significant problems persist, and we'll be guided by the following principles. The first, and something I touched on earlier, is responsibility, and this operates at all levels. Individuals need to be responsible and accountable for their behaviour online. Businesses must ensure that their services are not open to manipulation and harmful behaviour, and must act swiftly if they are. And government has a responsibility to inform and educate and provide the right incentives and penalties where content and behaviour doesn't meet standards of decency. The second is respect. Respectful engagement online and respect for the individual in accord with community standards. Respectful behaviour online doesn't occur in isolation from the real world. How we treat each other offline will inevitably influence how we treat each other online. And alongside responsibility and respect, we believe in fostering a level playing field. There are a few examples in history where the dominance of single firms has been positive for society. Competition delivers enormous benefits to the Australian community and the economy. In the online environment, this translates into the ability of all companies and individuals to participate and deliver products and services online. And lastly, we're focused on trust and security. Australians should be able to control their online footprints and their personal data. They should be able to have a degree of trust and confidence in online news sources. And when these things don't happen, we will look at the range of options available to support them. We are at a turning point. There is global recognition that the internet cannot be that other place where community standards and the rule of law does not apply. The internet is too interwoven into the fabric of our lives. We must ensure that Australia is positioned to maximise the social and economic benefits of the online world. We've made a start. There are a number of challenges, and where we're required to act, we will do so. Thanks very much.
Many thanks to Minister Fifield for a detailed speech and ending right on 30 minutes. So we've got plenty of time for questions and discussion, but even so, I ask people to keep their comments brief. Early on, you mentioned defamation, you mentioned bullying. I think it's fair to say Australians are pretty widely aware of the concept of bullying, perhaps not so aware of the concept of defamation, and yet obviously some people are getting caught in a situation they never would have thought they would be in. I mean, is there any role for a government in warning Australians about that new problem, which wasn't really around when the defamation laws were formed or even when they were revised in recent times? Yeah.
No, thanks, Jared. I think there is a role for government to warn the community about this. We are going to see some interesting test cases in the near future. We've seen a number of celebrities of late put their hands up and say that they've in effect been defamed by being linked with particular products. And I think Eddie Maguire is one who comes to mind about being linked to a particular personal product that he wasn't too pleased to be associated with. So there are new avenues, new opportunities for people to be defamed, to be associated with products that they don't endorse. There are a number of actions being taken in the courts, which I think will further define this area.
Minister, you gave us a great summary of many of the challenges that the internet faces and what governmental intervention might look like. After all, that was the topic. But I'd be interested in your thoughts on the flip side, which is one of the productivity benefits, etc., that we can see from the internet, or we talk about the third, if not the fourth, industrial revolution.
Well, tremendous productivity enhancements, and I don't want to leave the impression that I take a dim, dark or negative view of the internet. I think the benefits are manifest. Our world is unrecognisable from when I was at school and university. The capacity for people to work from home, to have markets around the world as an individual, where before that just was not possible. But we do need, as a government, to take stock of the risks and the dangers, which is, as you know, the focus of my speech, that we do want the laws of the land to apply in the online world just as they do in the physical world. But you're right, we are on the cusp of, in effect, another industrial revolution. Part of that is by courtesy of new technologies such as 5G for mobile connectivity, the Internet of Things, which will pretty much link almost every household item that today we take for granted, whether it be your fridge, your washing machine, whether it be your car. This is going to transform our lives in a way that kind of hurts your head. That's really the next frontier in the online environment. Is having a connected world, and it is reasonable to describe it as the next industrial revolution.
Minister, today an article in the Australian, it could have been by Mark David, spoke about broadcasting as we know it disappearing, because everything in the world today seems to be on demand, which has been made possible by digital, internet, whatever. Do you see broadcasting, except for the news, which is 24/7, broadcasting challenged at the moment, and will we see it disappear in the next couple of decades?
Well, inevitably, the future for people accessing every sort of content is online. We are different to the United States in terms of the penetration of our free-to-air broadcasters. In the US, they've got much deeper penetration by cable. They don't have the same penetration of free-to-air. And we're already seeing, over time, people moving from free-to-air platforms to online platforms. Now, that will continue. The $64,000 question is, how fast will that happen? Some people who you talk to say, well, it'll all be done and dusted in 5 years. Others say, well, it's probably more 10 to 15 years. I think free-to-air TV will persist for longer than we anticipate. In terms of free-to-air, we shouldn't forget radio. Radio is actually going great guns. The future of radio is bright. So, yes, there will be an inexorable shift. But I don't think it will happen at quite the speed of those who were saying in 5 years' time, no one's going to be tuning into 9, 7, 10, Prime, Wynn, Southern Cross, Oz Stereo. They'll be with us for a little while yet.
Minister, thank you. Given the breadth of this huge problem of policing all this stuff, given the length of time it takes for the legal profession to acquire the necessary information around a case in any individual circumstance, the ability of the legal profession to be able to effectively get in there and mount cases against this massive animal which is spreading all the time. Your comments, please.
Yeah, well, I'll look at it in two different ways. The first is through our Office of the E-Safety Commissioner. You're right that legal processes can take too long to affect the removal of material, for instance, which is why we legislated the world's first kids cyberbullying takedown regime, where the E-Safety Commissioner has the power to direct social media organisations to take material down, where she has the capacity to issue an end-user notice to tell someone to cease and desist. So it's very important that we have regulatory bodies that can act straight away within a matter of hours to have material taken down where there's serious risk of harm, particularly for kids. So We've also moved in that direction, as I mentioned, with the issue of the non-consensual sharing of intimate images, where we've not only augmented the criminal provisions, but we've also introduced for the first time civil penalties, because they can be whacked on quicker and easier and with a lower evidential burden than criminal penalties. So you want to have a range of mechanisms available for regulators. Flipping it to the other side of things, the issue of market power, that's where I think the work of the ACCC is very important, because at the heart of what they're doing is seeing if there are competition issues, if there are issues of market power that have been created by virtue of the digital world. So their work looking at online platforms is going to be extremely interesting.
Tony? Is it on?
Yes, to speak.
Right up to the pops. It's on. Yeah.
Alan?
Oh. Come on.
Okay.
It's right good. Into it. Put it right up to your mouth.
Just to start.
It's good to hear that the government is taking the issues of fraud and uncivil behavior very seriously, and that's really good to hear. But there's another problem with respect to the internet that would be a good deal more difficult to deal with, but nevertheless is serious, and that is the excessive use of social media, particularly by children. This is a problem identified by the Japanese, as you no doubt know, as a type of addiction, and they're taking it quite seriously. So my question is, would you see there be a role for the government in somehow, say, working with other bodies, such as educational bodies or others, short of the heavy hand of regulation, in, first of all, understanding this problem, and then helping to do something about it?
The short answer is yes, but I'm going to introduce a radical concept, which isn't always in vogue, and that is the concept of parents. Parents have a prime responsibility to educate their kids about being smart online, being resilient online, but also not always being online. Parents should set ground rules, should set boundaries for what happens in the home for devices. And I also think that schools should be very strong and say, no, you cannot have those devices in the classroom. You've got to focus on what's before you. So there's a really strong role for parents. There's a really strong role for schools. And as with so many things, if kids are given the skills to discern right from wrong, if kids are given the capacity and the confidence to say no to something, then it doesn't matter whether it's the online world or anything else in life, they'll be well placed. Parents have got to give kids the skills, and they've also got to set the boundaries at home.
Sir?
Thank you, Minister. Thank you, Minister. It's been alleged in the United States that foreign powers use internet to impact, and especially social media, to impact on electoral processes and on democratic institutions. Is there any danger in Australia that similar things could happen, and what are you doing about it?
Yeah. Well, it's important for all governments to always be looking at the integrity of their electoral processes. And I can assure you that our relevant agencies do just that. Obviously, we look around the world. Our agencies talk to their partners overseas. So, yes, it's something that we're mindful of, and you can rest assured that it does receive the appropriate attention.
Minister, you talked about the threats. I don't think you mentioned criminals acting for phishing and that sort of thing, but more importantly, governments like Russia and China attacking using the internet.
Well, you're right. There are a lot of scams that happen online, and regrettably, scams were with us in the pre-internet world, but the online environment does give scammers new opportunities. It's no longer just the telephone scams or someone knocking at the front door. People are inundated with what might look to be harmless emails that nevertheless, if you click on them and click on the links, you can find yourself in a world of trouble and a world of pain. Again, to some extent, this comes back to educating people, but you are always going to have people who want to rip others off, and you're always going to have vulnerable people who can't see what's being attempted. And particularly older Australians, lonely people who might receive an email advising them that their true love is just a continent away. And if only they send $5,000, then the gap can be bridged. So yeah, they are real concerns. The ACCC put a lot of work into this. It's a constant effort. No sooner do you eliminate one scam, but they evolve and present a new sort of scam. So it's a situation of constant vigilance. The reason I didn't directly touch on that is it's a little bit outside my direct sphere, but it is something that we're going to be mindful of, and something that all of us in government have got to talk about to make sure people are aware.
Question there.
Minister, you mentioned a few interesting words: disruption, piracy, copyright, etc. And I was interested to hear about what the ACCC are going to be doing, but I'm interested in a comment. You have a situation now where companies such as Google, under American fair use laws, can use output of journalists from regular conventional media organisations who pay journalists and pay taxes and all those boring things, and take 80% of the income, and off it goes. And that all goes to the US, and they don't have to pay tax, which is quite nice. Now, I know that we are slowly working our way through that, but the end point of that whole thing is that the people who employ journalists won't be able to employ them, so then Google will have to go and do that themselves and might come up with some other formula. But do you see that as being a concern at all, or is that just the way the world is?
No, it is a concern, and that was really the prime driver behind the reference that we gave to the ACCC. Was that it's becoming increasingly difficult for what you might call traditional media in Australia to survive, to get an income. Now, you can say, well, technology changes and, some people will prosper and others will sink. And there's absolutely some truth to that. But what we wanted the ACCC to do, to look at, was to see if there is any market power that is being used in a way to lessen competition. If there are advertising arrangements which are anti-competitive. And I don't have the answers to those questions, which is why we commissioned Rod Sims in his very detailed and forensic capacity to dive into these issues, because we do want to see quality journalism. We do want to see Australian journalism survive. We do want to see people who create get a fair return on what they do, whether that's artistically or whether that's publishers. It's in the interests of the strength of our democracy that we do have that diversity, and part of what we want Rod to do is to see if there are things that shouldn't be happening that are undermining that potential ongoing media diversity in Australia.
Well, this morning I read a quite interesting thing by Dr. John McLean,
And I was so interested in it that I decided that I wanted to look him up. So I Googled him. And although he is an outstanding Australian, all that Google would tell me was that he was a psychiatrist in Florida. And I saw that as a prohibition on him having a voice in this country imposed by Google. Do you see this sort of thing, and do you think it's a problem?
The John McClane who comes to mind, was that, I'm just trying to think, was that Bruce Willis's character in Die Hard?
No.
It wasn't. No, I've just got a mental block. Anyway, that one rings a bell. Your concern is that there's an entry on a particular website that's... A well-known website, yeah. You have to give me a bit more information because I'm not immediately familiar with John.
Nor really, it's a...
Okay, so we might take that one offline, yeah. So to speak.
Okay, there was a question here. There we are.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I wanted to have a few words about the issue of truth on the internet. All societies and all democracies function because people have a fundamental consensual understanding about reality, values, and beliefs. And most of the 300 years since the Enlightenment, liberal democracies had that information filtered. It was experts, scientists, media that actually communicated to us some view of what reality is like. One of the consequences of the internet is that filtering has stopped functioning. Anything, it may be a conspiracy theory, it might be complete disinformation, it might be fake news, can get instant access to everybody. And some analysts think that the greatest danger of the internet, that it will undermine the fundamental underlying principles by which our society functions. That means that government might have a role in the future, essentially acting as a truth monitor, trying to get rid of fake news, dishonest, malevolent, misleading information. It's a very difficult question because the definition of truth itself is highly problematic. But can you see a future for government to deal with that issue?
Yeah, the problem is always who do you choose to be the truth monitors and who chooses them? You're right. Pre-internet, we essentially received curated news that had gone through an editorial process of some sort, whether it be print, radio, or TV. And that meant that there were certain, you know, baseline standards. They mightn't have always been terrific standards, but there was at least, you know, a standard, a filter, some curating of what people received. So they had, whether they should have had or not, a level of confidence. They did have a level of confidence. Obviously, that's not there now, as you rightly point out. And although, I still think of the internet as something relatively recent, given that didn't exist when I was at school or university. But it is still fairly recent in our history, and I think we're still catching up as a society in terms of imparting the skills of discernment to people as they grow up, that you've got to discern for yourself, that you've got to have your own frame of reference. You've got to have your own worldview against which you measure things. So I don't think the answer is a government-appointed panel that will determine what is true or not. I mean, it's, you know, one of the reasons why we don't have truth in political advertising, because who on earth could be the person you'd appoint to determine that? Yeah, it's not immediately clear to me that there is that role for government, but I think that there is a role for the platforms themselves to start to put in something approaching editorial processes. And I mentioned that some of the platforms are now engaging universities and establishing, you know, fact-check units that can at least provide some measure that what you read has gone through a process. So I think the answer is probably twofold: more of that, and a greater recognition that some of these platforms are, although they don't like to admit it, getting very close to being publishers, and that means that they should have particular responsibilities. They do have particular responsibilities about the material on their platforms. That's one part of it. The other part of it is giving people the skills of discernment. Ultimately, there's no substitute for that.
We're getting very close to the end. We've got time for two quick questions. So we'll go John and Anthony. That's it. John?
Minister, sorry. I had the benefit on the ferry coming to listen to your interesting talk this afternoon of listening to the ABC PM program on my smartphone through a digital platform. When will the public receive the benefit of the competitive neutrality report which is coming to you?
In the near future. If it's not in my office yet, it will be very shortly. So you won't have to wait long for that. And I've just been racking my brain on John McClane. Officer John McClane was Bruce Willis's character in the Die Hard franchise. And his wife was Holly Gennaro.
If anyone's got any questions on film, I'll give them a preference. Anthony's got the microphone.
Mitch, hi, and thank you for your speech. And there's a lot of improvements, a lot of reforms there. For a young bloke, you've got a lot of experience in politics and politics in government. I was wondering whether you might be able to reflect on government in the late 90s and government in the late teens. What do you wish you enjoyed then that you could have now? And what would you have loved to have had then in politics that you now enjoy?
That's deep, Anthony. One of the things that I wish we had now that we had then was Anthony Bencher working in government. That's one of them. I'm going to have to ponder that for a second, Anthony. Let me just reflect on some good things in politics, in government, the late 1990s, where I see that we still enjoy that in government today. I think it was great, John Howard, Peter Costello, they would mark out some territory, they would put a proposition forward, and they would argue it morning, noon and night. That there would be no talkback radio that was neglected. And they use the power of argument, the power of persuasion, to carry the community. That the community wasn't necessarily initially at the point that they were, but the approach was: you deal with people where they are, you mount your case, and then you can take them forward. I've got to say, I'm seeing that in Scott Morrison. Scott is someone who leaves no microphone neglected. He is out there putting a number of propositions forward. He's arguing the case. And I think something that all of us in public life have to continually remember, me included, is that our core business is advocacy and persuasion. That it's a little bit, I guess, wearing my manager of government business in the Senate hat, with the Senate crossbench. You know, your starting point with them can't be where you think they should be, or where you want them to be. The starting point has got to be where they are. You respect that. You put your case forward, and when you do that, you can get good outcomes. And I think that's a good reminder for us in public life that that's what we're there for. We're there to advocate. We're there to persuade.
Many thanks. There are a lot of people here tonight, so I'll be very brief. Look, many thanks to Minister Fifield for a very broad talk on an important issue and then taking about half an hour questions and discussions on all sorts of things, plus an occasional film commentary, which I've found of particular value. So Cabinet Ministers are very busy people, and the fact that the Minister's found an hour tonight to come along and talk to us, so we're very grateful for. I hope you'll come back in the future, but for the now and the immediate term, thank you and good luck.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.